The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
I want to explore one avenue with you. Having said what I believe music is and how it fits all of life, you can expect there to be continuities between the experience of music and many other of life's experiences. Probably the two human experiences that are most commonly associated with music are language and emotions. Some people even say that music is very simply a language. That's what it is. Now, I have a lot of sympathies with that because I think there are indeed many close parallels between music and language. For many people, language at least seems to be the perfect metaphor for music. And then you get statements like, music is the universal language. I remember when I was a kid in the 50s, and Benny Goodman was sent over to Moscow as our musical ambassador during the Cold War. And the idea was that though we were at odds politically, because music was a universal language, everybody would understand and there would be a great communication. Of course, there was a lot of slippery, or maybe not very careful thought. The Moscovites presumably enjoyed the sounds of the Benny Goodman Orchestra because there was enough in their culture, enough in their own musical language, so that it would make sense. But communication in art, in many ways, is not the same as communication in language. At the negotiating table, the language used and translated fails to provide good feeling and agreement, not because it's verbal as opposed to musical, but I think precisely because it does communicate. It communicates content that just people don't agree on. I also remember in the sort of 60s, at the height of some of the talk about the generation gap, one evening, Walter Cronkite, we always listen to Walter Cronkite and on the news, and one evening he was covering one of the universities that was in turmoil because of student rebellion, and I forget which one now. But they interviewed students talking about the generation gap and the communication gap, and my parents don't understand me because we have a communication gap. And Walter Cronkite said, I don't think they have a communication gap. I think they communicate extremely well. They just don't agree. You know, that's it's a funny way of saying that you just disagree. Language can't change people's ideologies. It might help clarify issues. The function of language is not to promote agreement. Benny Goodman's jazz gave pleasure in Moscow because it was warm and swings and 100 other features of his jazz style. But the Russians agreed about the virtues of the music, not about Western ideology. The thing wouldn't work quite so well if America had sent Navajo Indians to perform a ritual rain dance instead of Benny Goodman. Or the type of music I mentioned the other day, the Inuit Eskimo throat game music, which until you know what's going on, and even when you do, sounds uncannily like people gargling. The reactions there would have been bewilderment, maybe anger. So that the analogy between music and language may be there, but it's at best a very weak one. To be sure, some features of music remind us of language. We can speak of phrases, periods, sentences, and so on in music. And more parallels exist than just that. Certain musical traditions are clearly derived from vocal influence. Think of the blues. The form, the music of the blues is very tightly connected to music, to the music of Black Americans. So is South Indian instrumental music. I mention that because a fair amount of scholarship has been done on this. Modern Indian performance practice reflects textual features of later Sanskrit poetry and of some of the modern vernaculars in a number of ways. First of all, the poems are characterized by refrain and stanza designs, which is not like the older poetry in which everything is an independent entity. Call and response is a feature of the music which is derived directly from the pattern of words. The poems are in a rondeau form, semantically and grammatically. The last words of the stanza are continued and completed logically in the beginning of the independent refrain. And third, there's usually a matching rhyme of stanzas with refrain, or even matching words, which gives you a natural flow back to the beginning. All of this translates the words directly into musical form. Nevertheless, although that analogy seems pretty obvious, there are a couple of problems with it, which I think you have to understand so that you don't go too enthusiastically into sweeping generalizations about music as language. First, not all musical forms are so closely dependent on language, even formally. Harold Powers teaches at Princeton. He's one of the most well-known experts on Indian music, has this to say. Until a few years ago, I took it for granted that I would find it easy enough to show that the parallels between music and language are as close and as deep elsewhere as they are in Indian classical music. But in recent years, work with non-Indian Asian music and in the history of European music theory has led me to think that the striking validity of the language-music analogy in Indian classical music is probably far from typical. It's not, though, that other musics are in no way formally like language. It's just that few musics are as much like language as Indian music is. So the first problem is that the direct connection between music and text is not the same from culture to culture and from genre to genre. The second problem is that there are a number of ways in which music is quite unlike language. For example, all human languages are apparently characterized by just about the same degree of complexity. Linguistically, there's great similarity from one language to another, despite all kinds of differences in structure and so forth. This is not true of different musical systems, which vary a great deal in complexity or density from one another. It's not only true of the kind or the amount of density, but of the type of musical texture as well. Gregorian chant is not connected to a five-voice fugue in the same way that French is connected to, say, Chinese. We're just talking about very different types of connections. And so while there is some benefit to looking at the music-language analogy, because music is often connected with the way we speak. Nevertheless, music is a larger and more different concept than just music. Music is also connected with the way we breathe, the way we run, the way we cook, the way we interrelate with one another. In other words, there's particular affinities with speech, but it has affinities with all kinds of other things as well. What about emotions? Same problem there. Music seems particularly closely connected to human emotions. Almost every culture, from the ancients to the moderns, agrees that whatever else music means, it means emotion. At the same time, it's almost impossible to find the key which relates music to a particular emotion in a safe way, unless you factor in an awful lot of cultural things. For example, portable kettle drums, a fifth apart, banged very loud, excited the Roman soldiers to do war. Very doubtful that it would have, you know, the same effect, emotional effect, on people who didn't know about the convention. The bagpipes will send the Scots into great combative moods. Very doubtful if they would have the same effect on other people. In other words, there is emotion connected with music, but it depends on so many other things that it would be wrong to reduce it to a kind of emotional analogy. At the same time, I think there are emotions peculiar or particular to music which are not quite like any other emotions. Now, when we get to discuss the book by Peter Kivi, this is going to come out. So I hope you'll prepare our discussion of that in a couple of weeks with great care. But the idea is that, yes, music, listening to music does evoke and produce a certain emotional response. When I listen to, you know, a Mozart string quartet, I'm deeply moved by it. But it's not the same as fear, love, joy, guilt, whatever, you know, the emotions might be. It's not strictly the same. There's something aesthetic. There's a particularly aesthetic emotion that is given its elan through music. So first, music and emotions are not narrowly related, because there's a lot of cultural factors to put into play. But second, music does provoke emotion, but it's its own special kind of music emotion, you might say. So having said that there are these analogies and these parallels, nevertheless, there is something unique about music, which is irreducible to something else. So music is human covenant response in the aspect of sound, and it can't be reduced to anything else, though there's plenty of parallels. We will pause now if anybody wants to discuss any of this. Yes, Esther.
Only one small question.
Ooh.
In your definition, human cultural activity ordered by the covenant, can you define the term ordered?
Yeah. What I mean by that is that God relates to the creation and to people in particular through an order which you can characterize variously as being a law order, because his covenant is a binding legal contract. You can characterize it as a grace order, because it's structured by his personal relationship to human beings, and a gracious one at that, one that's undeserved, and so forth. So that when you're doing music, the music reflects this order, this structure of this relationship. Now, Meredith Klein has spent a lot of time elaborating the particulars of the covenant, and he's got about 10 things which a covenant treaty, 10 components that a covenant treaty has, which becomes then the order you know, there's the prologue, and there's the historical introduction, and then there's the redemptive fact, and then there's the stipulations, the curses, you know, all of those things that he says. And I think that music, being a human activity in a covenant relationship, necessarily fits into that order. Now, when we get to the fall, we'll see that instead of reflecting God's grace, music may reflect rebellion and revolt against that gracious presence of God. Although his covenant of grace, his common grace, still affects us. Instead of law, you know, and so forth, the music will go for the antinomian, the chaotic or whatever it might be. But it has to take into account the order.
It's not that determining right or wrong. It's ethical value.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't mind using the word command. It doesn't bother me. It seems to me it is at one level a command. I talked about mandate.
So in a way, it carries both. The human cultural activity commanded and organized by the covenant, basically.
Okay.
Is that
sure. Sure. Sounds good. Yeah. I think that because, you know, here I believe with Kuiper that life can be divided into different spheres. I think there are unique spheres which can't be reduced to one another. So that, you know, government can't be reduced to church and church to family, and you can't reduce logic to psychology and so forth. I believe that music is one of those spheres. I'm using it very loosely now, but I think music has a characteristic which is unique and not reducible to something else. There's tons of analogies, but it's not reducible to something else. When I listen to, you know, a Beethoven symphony, it calls forth in me emotions that only music can call forth. These emotions wouldn't be there if somebody told me what the symphony was about, or danced what they thought the symphony was about, or gave me a psychological explanation of how the symphony works, or anything like that. They're all valid, and they all might have things, but it's the actual music that brings forth my feelings. And those feelings, I think, I don't want to make them into something strange or different. You know, they're obviously tied in to other emotions. But when I go home at night and I put on, you know, a Beethoven symphony, if I'm listening, it is for a unique purpose. It's not to make me happy or sad or guilty or innocent, or, you know, hopefully there'll be some feelings of joy that will come out of it. But it's unique musical emotions. Music can provoke something that nothing else can. Just like I think words can. Or my favorite person. Or, you know, all of those call forth certain things that can't be reduced to another. There's a fascinating psychologist named Ernst Mayr who wrote a lot about emotion and meaning in music. And I think he does a brave attempt, but it's ultimately, I think, disappointing to try and reduce music to a psychological, almost behavioralistic experience. And he believes that what music does is it creates tension and release, tension and release. Okay. Some music does that, you know. In fact, they say that a key to a good story is to create expectations by tension and then to frustrate the expectations by bringing it to another level, and then more tension, and then frustration, and more. But to me, that's not true of all music, and it isn't a particularly universal key to even the music it's supposed to be about. And it also applies to the other arts, and to many things. I mean, soccer games, you know. Talk about tension. And, So, you know, it's certainly there's something there, but I think the misguided thing is to try to reduce music to something earthly rather than to this covenant thing. You know, here, another type of example of this has been going on for a long time. The Pythagoreans are probably the first to do it, but right up through today, in the 18th century, there was a man named Rameau, who wrote a lot of operas, and he thought a great deal about music. And he wrote a book on music theory in which he said that the properties of harmony and of all of our music conventions can be reduced to the stretched string principle. You take a string and you stretch it and you pluck it and it makes a note. Then if you take half of that, it's an octave higher. Two-thirds of that, kind of a fifth. Yeah, mathematically. Now, this is very intriguing. However, it breaks down at very important points. Two-thirds isn't quite a fifth. And the more you go into details, like finding sevenths or intervals of a second or whatever, the mathematics are not even close. Piano tuners will tell you that if you want to tune a piano, you can't be purely mathematical, or you'll only have two or three keys that work, and the rest will all be completely out of whack. The mean tuning, yeah. Right, you average out. You make compromises. You pull in your fists and you stretch your fourths. And so, I think all attempts to reduce music to something else, without taking into account this covenant picture, are going to destroy its inner coherence. Mm-hmm. I believe that music does have a message. I'm not talking about words now. I'm just talking about sounds. When you add words, it's even more complicated. But the sounds, I believe music is a kind of metaphor. It's a kind of architecture which conveys meaning. But it's not, even that isn't reducible to words. Yes, you can speak about music, but you can't just say in a paragraph what Beethoven has said in a symphony. The message of Beethoven's symphony is a music message. Now, of course, the opposite extreme is people who say, oh, I don't want to ever talk about music. That's wrong, because you can. There are analogies, or that there's no tension and release, or that there's no, you know, stretched string. All of that has some validity. But I think the problem is that we don't want to miss the fact that music and all of the arts have their own conventions for meaning. And they are musical conventions. And those in turn involve being cultural conventions as well, so that an Inuit throat game doesn't have the same conventions as, you know, Bob Dylan's folk music or whatever. They're different conventions. But they're still, it's endemic, it's idiomatic to what music is, that it express itself in terms of itself and not in terms of something else. So, you know, when you talk about how does music have meaning, and that's the subject of our talk next time, we'll see that it's both an easy thing, because you can say in words, in so many words, that here's what the composer was saying, and a very hard thing, because you can't reduce it to words. Yeah. It's interesting. I have a book that's completely out of print now and out of date and everything. But when I first wrote it, I sent it to my college roommate, who's remained a very close friend, but who's a Jewish skeptic. He's not a believer. And but we lived together because of common interests. The first of which was music. And he read it, and he said, this is really wonderful stuff. I have come to almost the same conclusions as you have, but for entirely different reasons. And so I think I communicated with him. And the next step would be to try and say, well, look, John, you don't think that this is just chance, do you? Think about your reasons and why, you know, how did you get there? And what about what I'm proposing? What's wrong with that? You know, this kind of stuff. So I think you can communicate with people if you've thought things through in many ways. You know, when I read reviews of concerts, the guy is communicating with me. And if I disagree with him, I'm either wrong and I have to be challenged, or there's a problem with his analysis, and I want to know what's at issue. So, just like anything else, you know, interpreting current events or whatever it might be, I think you can do this in music, and you can have some success. I think it's important to kind of know a bit about what you're talking about so that you're not just throwing out emotional likes and dislikes, but... Is that
what I'm getting at? It's science and transcendence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. See, I'd want to be careful with that for all the reasons that I'm talking about here. I mean, I think music is indeed inexplicable apart from the covenant. At the same time, it's not a mysterious power. That has the goddess Ea in the middle or anything like that. So, you know, when I'm explaining this to non-Christians, depending on who I'm talking with, I will want to emphasize, hey, this is human. Don't mystify it. Or I'll say, wait a minute, this comes from God. You can't just reduce it to numbers. You know, both things are true. Now, I think that's Jubal's legacy to us, is that it's a blessing of God, so it is from God, but it's a human cultural mandate. So it's truly human. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do I think it's been jaundiced in our opinion or in reality? Yeah. Definitely. And that has given part truth and part error. The part truth is that indeed, compared to what Seth was doing, cultural activity was often a trap, a temptation, a way to hide from God. You know, it's without doubt that there's some irony in the way Genesis describes the first people who build cities, because the words there, I don't have my Hebrew here with me, but there are a couple of words in building the city which imply hiding from God. And so... that's the part truth of it, that relative to worship, human cultural activity is fragile and sinful and so forth. The part error, however, is the Manichaean error, that it's all black and white, that all culture is bad because it came from, you know, sinful people, and that if we could just do without it, we'd be much better off going around worshiping all day. That's not what the people of God did. They wrote poetry and they did the, you know, the vineyard songs and the victory songs, all that stuff that I talked about. So it was, the problem was, what do you do with culture, not whether culture in itself is bad. And many Christians, I'm afraid, are a bit Manichaean in that they somehow suspect or fear the arts as being necessarily evil. And you get a lot of talk about how, you know, the arts are dangerous, you know, and you'd be better off without them. That's just not... See, I don't think that's what they did. I think the text here is only giving a part of the picture. I'm sure in the Sons of Cain there was worship, probably of false gods, and I'm sure in the Sons of Enoch, or rather the sons of Seth, there were culture producers. That's the whole descendants of Seth is to be the precursors of the people of God, you know. I mean, Noah is the next in line as a godly person. he knows how to make arcs. And so, you know, I think that would be a contrast that's not intended by the author. The author intends to show, to be sure, a relative virtue in worship over culture producing. But he doesn't intend to say that worshippers don't do culture. Well, they weren't all wiped out. There were six that remained, and they continued to do the very thing that God had told the human race to do at the beginning, which is to have children and replenish the earth, and so on. And it's carefully reiterated. The language of the creation is carefully echoed in the language of Noah's covenant, which is a universal covenant. And so it's, I think you find in the whole structure of Genesis a separating out of the true believers from those who rebel against God. But in no case do the true believers opt out of the world or out of culture. They engage in culture, but it's relativized by the higher virtue of salvation and trusting in God. Let's run through the next two categories so you get a complete picture here. And maybe next time I will give you something of an outline so you can have it for your own notes. The music is affected by the fall or by sin. And some of what we've just said is, of course, very germane, because culture has become characteristic of rebellion in a fallen world, and it's no longer simply a pure expression of God's blessing mandate. It's interesting, back to Jubal, that in Genesis 4, not Jubal, but Lamech boasts in a kind of war whoop to his wives. Ada and Zillah, listen to me, wives of Lamech, hear my words. I've killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged seven times, then Lamech 77 times. Here you have the gift of poetry, possibly accompanied by music, we don't know, which is used in a prideful way. And so in a fallen world, music is still a covenant-ordered human activity, but it has become problematic and sinful. Very interesting to consider in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 8, where the author, who presumably represents Solomon, says that he amassed silver and gold for himself, the treasures of kings and provinces. I acquired men and women singers, and a harem as well, the delights of the heart of a man. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I refused my heart no pleasure. Well, he's here turned legitimate cultural activity, including music, into something of a coveted, sinful acquisition. And therefore music actually becomes, in a funny way, burdensome rather than a vehicle of redemption. Many ways in which we could describe this. One of the most striking is in several musical references to music in the book of Amos. In Amos, music is described as distorting David's harp. Amos 6:5, God is speaking woe through the prophet to the complacent people in Zion and Samaria. And among other things, he says, "You lie on beds and inlaid with ivory, you lounge on your couches, you dine on choice lambs and fatted calves, you strum away your harps like David, and improvise on musical instruments. You drink wine by the bowlful and so forth. Here music has become a drunken accoutrement of degenerate living. And the reference to David is not innocent here, because they do it skillfully. David was a skillful player. And they've turned that very skill into something that is an abhorrent feast to God. So here all of a sudden, music accompanies all of life, but it's all of fallen life. Instead of the glorious sounds of covenant faithful music, it's the noisy sounds of apostasy. Amos 5:23. Away with the noise of your songs, I will not listen to the music of your harps, but let justice roll on like a river. Daniel 3:7 is another reference to that. So here, music becomes the stuff of seduction, of mockery, of mourning, of war, of hedonistic feasting, and has become a covenant breach. Now, we could open a parenthesis on whether music is actually an instrument of Satan, whether there's any demonic influence in music, and that's a long, long story. I think what you have to say is that there is evidence, indeed, that Satan will use music, just as he will use alcohol or any other part of the creation, to be the metaphorical accompaniment of his seductive schemes. What I don't think we want to say is that somehow music has gained magical psychoacoustical powers, which, like a drug, can sort of drag us down. Now, this is a very long discussion. We don't want to get into it here. I would say the safeguard against this Manichaean idea of music is our general theology of good and evil. Evil is not a thing; it's rebellion against God. It's a moral quality, and whether we do speech or actions or cultural activities, those are good or bad according to whether they're faithful or unfaithful to God's law, not because they've become things that can get you. One other interesting consideration here about music in a fallen world is that while music may be the noise of rebellion, there also can be the judgment of silence. Hosea 2:11. God says, I will stop all her celebrations, her yearly festivals, her new moons, her Sabbath days, all appointed feasts. I will ruin her vines, and so on. God judges Israel by stopping all of this. And in verse 15, there is the hope again that while evil music has ceased, there I will give back to her vineyards in a better world. I will make the valley of Achor the door of hope. There she will sing as in the days of her youth, the innocent songs of youth. Similar reference in the book of Revelation 18:22. Often, as you know in the Bible, silence is the mark of God's judgment. And then song is the great innocent song is the great answer of redemption. God's covenant relationship, just as it was expressed as a good part of reality and creation, is expressed here in judgment with music. finally, music and redemption. A lot of things to say here. I'll just summarize a few. One of the things that you might wonder is, why are there so few references to music in the New Testament, if it's such an important part of our life? Well, I think there are two answers to this. The first and the most basic answer is, you don't need them. We've got the Old Testament. There's no reason to make an artificial separation between new and old. Nothing has been abrogated. But the second thing to say is that there are some music references, and the same emphases are given in the New Testament as were given in the Old. And that is that music is good, music has become fallen, but music will also characterize the new redeemed world of the believers. Very rich teaching in all of Scripture on the fact that when God redeems his people, new music is called for. I will sing a new song is a phrase that is given over and over again throughout the Bible. Psalm 33:3. Psalm 40:3. Isaiah 42:10. And Revelation 15:3. Only the redeemed can properly sing the new song. Revelation 14:3 and 15:3. It's a song for those who know Christ and who are regenerate. And the new song is sung from the heart. Psalm 108 and Psalm 138:1. And also Colossians 3:16, making melody with your hearts to the Lord. And just as the good music of creation is meant to accompany all of life, so the better music of the new creation is to accompany all of life. It can be done in families and small groups. Matthew 26:30. Or Acts 16:25. It can be done in the assembly. Psalm 149. Or Ephesians 5:19. And it echoes and pervades the whole earth. Psalm 96 and Psalm 100. So the new song is a song of the new covenant believer, just as the song of creation was the song of the human being ordering his covenant relation in the aspect of sound. And just like the created music is neither divine in a magical sense, nor is it purely human, so the new song is neither divine in a magical sense, nor is it purely human. The ultimate source of the new song is God, who puts the song in our hearts. God who sings over his people, Zephaniah 3:17. Christ who leads his people in song, Psalm 22:22, and Hebrews 2:11. And the Holy Spirit, who incites music in the believing community, Ephesians 5:19. The source is God, yet it's not magical. It is a song that is human, for human beings and by human beings. It has the full range of human virtues. Psalm 101, Psalm 145:7. It can be used for prophecy or edification. It can be used for admonition, and indeed for all of the activities of life, from work to rest to marriage to whatever part of life that we may be involved in. So once again, the new song of redemption is in many ways parallel to the song of creation, but it is heightened, it is better, it is more glorious. It needs to be clear so that worshipers will worship decently and in order, 1 Corinthians 14:16. It needs at times to be joyful because of redemption, many references. It needs at times to be mournful because of sin. But at all times, it is to be new. Now, this opens up a lot of questions about how are we to judge music as being the new song? How do we know it's good? How do we know it's Christian? And my very succinct answer to that is that while there's no verse, back to the very beginning of what we said, or there's no single aesthetic principle from the Bible that is a key or is some kind of law, nevertheless, there is such a close analogy between music and the moral life that you could develop a whole Christian aesthetic based on the Ten Commandments. Music, therefore, is good if it doesn't have other gods. How does it do that? Well, musicians have to work on that problem. Music is good if it doesn't provoke covetousness or a sense of stealing or a sense of adultery. How does it do that? Well, musicians have to work on that problem. And I say that because I don't want to reduce music to words or even to moral commandments, but I do think there are analogies that are so close that this can be done. Use the extreme and obvious example on one side and then on the other. The extreme and obvious example of rebellious music would be John Cage. We've talked about him before, who believed that the ultimate principle of the universe was chance. And so music is not even music for him, it's just purposeless play, was his exact expression. And he'll do things like wheel a Steinway 9-footer out onto the pavement of a big city and have the most famous pianist of that city come out, and he'll close the lid of the piano for 4 minutes and 33 seconds, and that piece is called 4-33. Now that's the extreme. On the other extreme would be a Bach cantata, which is music for worship by God's people. It's clear, it has resolution, it has joy, it has lamentation in the proper places and so on. It perfectly, or as much as you could find in a fallen world, translates the moral principles of the Ten Commandments into the music of the Northern German Baroque of the 18th century. Now, between those two extremes, there's a whole lot of less obvious ones, and you know, the hard work of doing music criticism has to be done, but I think it can be done, so that you can arrive at some standards and norms for music of redemption without having recourse to a couple of verses about, you know, chords or rhythms or sequences or whatever. Okay? Boy. Music in the Bible, 2 hours. Ooh. All right, next time we're actually going to listen to music. A revolutionary concept.